I did, but it was my father who's allowed to go through the, he's in the
D&D.
That's allowed to call through, yeah. All right.
Put him on.
Yeah, put him on the show.
We've got our first caller, which is strange because this is not a call-in show.
Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 26 for Friday, the 26th of September, 2025. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, what does the New South Wales government have in store? Are your VM hosts at risk? Google getting sued again? Plus, what's about to happen to Chrome? Find out in the AI wars. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I am awesome, mate. Glad to be here.
Excellent, excellent. And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, Ian?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. Been a good fortnight. I didn't sleep the best last night, I have to say, but here, perky and shiny and ready to record the show.
That's good. I mean, you look well. I mean, you didn't sleep well.
That's the main thing, right?
Yeah, not as good as Ian's mustache over there.
That's boy.
Luxurious.
It is getting the character about it that it deserves.
I have to take a nice headshot for you and put it up on the podcast. Like.
It is. Yeah, we do need to do that, don't we? We need a Discord server or we need something like that. So we might look into that. Actually, if you go to Discord and you go to the, what is it, the Google, tell us about the Google community in Discord, Ian, because I've been on there a little bit. I post on there occasionally.
Yeah, so there is a Google Developers Online Discord server, and there's a heap of different channels underneath the server. There's AI-specific ones, there's workspace-specific ones. There's just private spaces for GDEs to chat with Googlers as well. It's a cool little Discord channel that or server I should say that that puts you in touch with well not only Googlers directly but also experts in the different areas of Google.
Yeah,
because there's lots and lots and lots of different areas of Google and a lot of experts hang out in there.
Mm. I had a problem there with my Google Developers Developers Plus account, and it wasn't showing me my benefits. A lot of people apparently had this problem.
Yep.
And I went on there, asked a question, and someone on there knew what the problem was and was able to fix it.
Yeah.
I couldn't get any help from this, the question, the support on the web page, but someone on there was able to fix it. So, it was a nice one.
Yeah, no, it's a good community. There's also Google's got a heap of different channels for messaging people. As GDEs, we also get a private Google group chat that happens as well. There's also public ones there as well.
Yep.
So yeah, no, it's good.
Yeah. So go and check that out. I do cross post the links to the show in the hash Google content creators or something like that. It is. Look out for that. And in the meantime, Dave, I think you said you got another printer. Is that right?
Yeah, been shopping.
Wow. Spending the big dollars.
Okay. I was sort of trying to hold off a little bit until we moved into the factory, but Bamboo Lab released last month their H2S printers. So we'd bought that X1C a couple of months ago and been testing it out. It was the first time we'd used a Bamboo Lab machine. And I wanted to benchmark it against our Prusas, which has been the backbone of our company. So I really liked the X1C. And this one was kind of the same thing, but bigger. It's sort of their new generation. Ordered it on Thursday night and it turned up Monday.
Yeah, they're quick, aren't they?
Not bad. Yeah.
I'm that's not bad. But this thing is 60 kilos. It is huge. Thankfully, I had my offsider here. So, all right, we'll two man lift. And I don't know, I'm bloody impressed so far. printed a giant dragon on it.
Yeah, and a giant, like, movable dragon too. This yeah, thing's massive.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a little test print that I like to do. So those little flexible dragons you see everyone sell at like fairs and stuff, the files are available online. So I chucked it in there and then just scaled it up to be the maximum size of the print bed. 16 hours later, I got this giant thing that's as long as my arm. It's about as thick as my wrist.
Yeah, right. I'm just looking at the website and it shows they're 3D printing a suit of armor.
Yeah. Yeah, it's big enough that you could do like full-size helmets with like heaps of room. That's not obviously what our business use case is, but it's more of giving an idea of the size. So at the moment, I've only just sort of done some minor test prints. I'm waiting on a few other parts to come in for it. We've got some special heat beds that we like to use to give a particular texture that sort of aligns to the rest of my products. So I'm waiting on that to come in. But what I'm sort of looking forward to, being able to use the additional size, because I've turned down work where I just couldn't really print things. I'd have to split them into multiple pieces and that's just not great.
And glue it together.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to being able to use the additional size, but also it's actively heated inside the chamber, which opens up the opportunity to use more engineering filaments and like carbon fiber infill and a few other things. So I think that's going to be where we're going. We're going to probably start changing some of our materials around.
And you've got an AMS too?
I do have the AMS too. Yeah.
And how cool is that thing?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I think if we go... So the AMS2 is a way to load multiple filaments, and if you want to do multicolor print, you don't just have to do multicolor, but if you want to, you can do multiple colors in a single layer, which is very nice. If you're doing logo work or you want to print miniatures and you want to do them in full color, you can do that with the AMS2. That's not really in our use case so much, but it probably means that I might shift to using like 1 kilo filament spools. Like they're at the more standard size as opposed to the really big ones that I currently do, because the big ones come on a plastic spool that I can't recycle, and it's a huge amount of waste that I would really like to get rid of. Yeah. Whereas if I can go to 1 kilos, I can either get cardboard spools or just refills.
The refills that Bamboo Lab do are really good and reasonably cheap for the refills as well. But to give you an idea, Banky, this is what you can do. Like this is a chip that I printed.
Casino chip. Mm.
Yep, and it's just got our Rifle Club's logo on it because it's what we use for handing out free burgers to people who come and try. But yeah, I printed them all in one take on our 3D printer because we've got the Bamboo Labs P1S. So it's got an AMS as well. So that's just 2 color, but I can do 4 color as well. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'm looking forward to using more of that. The only issue that I've got with it at the moment is it's not yet supported in their farm management software, which is the thing that I was super impressed with the X1C, but it is on their roadmap. Like the printer's only just come out. They haven't finished doing all the API tie-ins to their product suite. So, I will hold off on buying more of these until it actually is supported. However, liking it so far.
Yeah, the P1S is supported in the farm management.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Not that I'm going to buy more of them because my wife might kill me if I do.
That's the problem with 3D printing, man. You can't just stop at one.
Well, I bought
5 years ago, it was one just sitting on my desk.
I bought an entire box of refills for it, like a 10-pack of refills. And the first question that came out of Rosie's mouth was, how much did that cost?
It's an investment.
An amount of money. The business paid for it. It's fine.
Well, yeah, it sounds like fun. I've got one sitting down in the garage, which I haven't even looked at. I've just got no time to even entertain that thought at the moment. I've got all this other stuff to play with anyway, so that's my bag.
So I've got the 3D printer now, and I've also got the laser cutter and engraver, and I just got the engraving fluid for, because yes, you need a fluid with a laser engraver, with a diode laser anyway. for steel and aluminium and stuff. So my next task is actually trying out this fluid on a bit of stainless steel to see how well a deep it cuts and how nicely it comes out. Because I actually want to be engraving an action.
Well, awesome. Sounds like fun, but let's move on. A couple of other items here we wanted to talk about. I just wanted to quickly mention a tool called Revance. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's a suite of tools that you can get. They've got a GitHub repo and maybe not so legitimately, but they there's clients for Spotify and YouTube and et cetera, and basically removes the ads for you, which is nice. They've been – Spotify has just gone on a warpath and gone after these guys and told them to take their repo down, which they've done. But apparently GitHub's pretty good in protecting these projects from these kind of actions, and GitHub themselves are like, we're not so sure about that. And Revance have gone, and apparently they're in talks at the moment, and they might be trying to bring it back. But it came as a surprise to everyone, because honestly, everyone thought YouTube would be the one that go after these guys, but not so much. It ended up being Spotify, the greedy, hungry Spotify that there is. I don't know. You may have heard my rant at the end of the show the other week, but. just another little thing for Spotify, and I'm still on my YouTube Music trial and trying it out. And I don't know. A couple of things about Spotify that I do like that YouTube Music's not doing. Moving from one client to the other, for instance, there's not really a desktop client for Windows per se. And if I go from like my laptop or my desktop onto my phone, it doesn't sort of know where I'm up to, or I can't switch over automatically. That kind of is a feature that I do use.
Yeah, it's the one that I miss the most, because I'll quite often be listening to music on my laptop and then I'll have to jump in the car and go somewhere, and I expect that the music is going to start off on the song that I just started on my desktop, and it doesn't.
It doesn't continue, no.
And that annoys me, but it is what it is. It's one of the very few downsides of moving away from Spotify.
Yeah. And I just read last night that I've got a DJ rig here behind me, and the new version of the DJ software that works with that integrates directly with Spotify. Mm. So that will be interesting to have a little play with. I haven't done that yet. Logging with your Spotify account and stream directly, and you can play the music directly from Spotify on your DJ rig. So that might be something that keeps me on Spotify. I don't know. I'm going to track this story. You know, I've got a little bit of an interest in the music side of things, and
you dabble.
I dabble a little bit. Yeah, we'll see how this one plays out for them. But because they've got a bunch of other projects outside of the Spotify client as well, so we'll see where it lands them. But in the meantime. We're going to talk about Broadcom a little bit today.
Just for a change. Right, and, okay.
There's not something we normally Dave, do.
You had an opinion on something, Dave. Why don't we hear it?
All right. I have a bit of a hot take. All right. We have spent, I don't know, I mean, this podcast has been running for a bit over a year, but I mean, even back in the previous incarnations, we've slammed Broadcom a lot. Over the last, 18 months, 24 months.
Hey, it's not us, though. It's the whole industry, right?
Well, no, I know, but we're happy to jump in and get the boots in a bit, right? Like, it's fun. it's fun to vent, right?
It is.
However, I had a bit of an epiphany the other day.
Oh, here we go.
What if Broadcom is right?
I can't fathom a universe where this would happen.
Okay,
elaborate, please.
Okay. Think of your current environment, all right? Well, I'm not just you, but like anyone, right? If you are just using VMware for just virtualization. You just got VMs. All right, you've got some hosts, you run on VMs,
yeah.
You got vCenter to manage, you know, make that a bit easier and get HADRS. If that's the case, get off VMware.
Yep.
All right. Hands down, move away from it. You know, if you've got other tools, say like your backup tool or whatever, only really works with VMware, where it makes it a bit more complicated for you. But there's a lot of other like opportunities out there for you.
Yeah, heaps.
All right, heaps of other tools. All right, you can go free, you can go paid, plenty of other vendors. We've covered heaps of them that mm-hmm. cover virtualization.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a bit of an upskill, I think, because you're going to, like, there's less engineers that can do it. There's less engineers that can do your Proxmox in a business ready sense, right, as opposed to just sort of home lab sort of dabbling. Yep. Right. But, you know, there's a learning curve you can sort of get through.
That's where it starts, though, right?
Well, yeah. For sure. I'm completely on board with, hey, do that. But think about the wider situation in larger enterprises,
mm-hmm.
right, where you have siloed teams, where you've got virtualization team that's running VMware. Maybe you have a dedicated storage team that does the backend stuff. You've got network guys, firewall guys. You then have DevOps teams. And then because you're moving to the cloud, you have cloud engineering or a cloud platform sort of group. Maybe you have different teams for GCP and AWS and Azure, like, because you haven't been able to hire engineers that could do everything. So you've got all these little silos everywhere, and you've got all these little bits. Broadcom's vision for VMware is not just virtualization. It is being the solution for your on-prem cloud, right? Oh. They want you using the whole stack. Now, I've worked in plenty of companies, same with you guys, where you were just using virtualization, and every time you met with your VMware rep, he was like, hey, have you tried vRealize? Right. And then you got a quote for vRealize automation and you're like, nah, yeah. I ain't paying for that.
Nah, bro. Right? Nah.
Yeah. I was like, nah. That sounds awesome, but I can't justify, you know, $200,000 worth of licensing for automation, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure how I'm gonna leverage it. Or, you know, NSX seems a little bit complicated. Nah, well, we'll just keep our Cisco gear on prem and we'll manage that. And, you know, we've got storage teams. Well, we're not interested in vSAN. Broadcom's vision is that, well, we've got this whole stack. You're going to get it all in your license. All right. It's like, yes, your pricing's gone up because you have to get all this extra stuff that you never wanted.
Mm.
But their vision is that, okay, the people who do pay it are then going to want to start extracting the benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because if you're paying for it, you might as well use ARIA, which is now what vRealize is. You're getting it, you might as well use it. You've got NSX there, you might as well use it. And the later version, like since sort of NSX 4.1 and integrated more in the new VCF 9, is the ability to build out more cloud constructs like VPCs and provide like tenants within your environment to your business stakeholders, right? So like you would give someone a project in GCP and off they go, you can do the same thing in VMware now. So the customers who are left behind, right? Like, yeah, the simpler suites are going to move out, but if you want to run on-prem, like what's your other option? It's OpenStack, maybe?
Nutanix.
Nutanix, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is just as Nutanix, expensive as VMware anyway.
It is. Right. So, and Nutanix is a great product as well, but yeah, it is in that same price range.
Yeah. OpenStack is good, but the learning curve on it is astronomical.
And find an engineer.
Well, because I built it from scratch.
So, all right. So, what you're saying, Dave, is you've got these smaller VMware estates, and they've got, you know, compared to the bigger ones, they've got a handful of VMs. Why don't you just get rid of your VMware and actually just move all that to cloud, right?
Correct. Like, yeah. Right. Little estate. You've got no value in being here.
You've got no value. Like, why haven't you moved already, kind of thing, right? But then you've got these other guys that are like, could and should have the full automation and the full on-prem cloud, but they just, they've just balked at it over the years, and they're just staying stagnant where they are. This is kind of forcing their hand.
Yeah. So, you know, so many environments where it's like, oh, yeah, we're the infrastructure team, like former companies that I worked for. It's like, oh, yeah, well, we kind of manage the legacy VMware environment. And then there's the cloud teams, the sexy teams that build out everything in AWS and GCP, and they've got DevOps engineers, and it's like, oh, yeah, but we still handcraft VMs on our side. Like, yeah, like this is,
you've got to move,
yeah, right?
I get that line of thinking, because, yeah, there is a lot of businesses out there that are like, meh, I just want to run VMs. Well, go and run them in the cloud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or go and pick a Proxmox or a Zen server, or insert other random hypervisor here, KVM. Go and run that. Don't run VMware just because you like the name VMware.
Yeah.
But if you are going to stay in it, you've got a big enough environment and you haven't made that move, but you found yourself like, oh, okay, we're going to have to sign up a 3-year commit, right? We're going to do it. Maybe we'll migrate off. Now you've got all the tooling there. Mm. Take the opportunity, right? Leverage it what you can, and think about, in terms of like your suite of all the tools and the other things that you bolt onto VMware, like, I don't know, you've got Juniper or Palo Alto like appliances and like firewall licensing that you're paying for, that maybe you could shift that inside of your VCF licensing. If you need VDefend Advanced, like you can do that. And then so you're making some money, you're getting some savings back by getting rid of some of your third-party tooling.
Yep. Migrate your firewalling into NSX distributed firewall, because then you can implement a proper north, south, east, west firewall, and you can do it all in a DevOps sort of fashion with Terraform.
Yeah, you can, and you can throw your vRealize automation in front of that and orchestration. Yep. You certainly can start providing a self-consumption developer experience to teams, as opposed to your, you know, infrastructure guys having to sit between the customers or the developers and their VMs. Like, you can start, just here you go. Here's a project. Mm. Here's some VPCs. Go spin up your VMs. Yep. You use this automation to do it.
And you can get rid of your Palo Alto firewalls. You can get rid of your F5 load balancers. You can put all of that into NSX. It does it all. And it does it all reasonably well. It doesn't give you I don't think the load balancing side of NSX gives you the same capability as an F5.
No, the base one doesn't.
It's pretty good.
RV load balancers pretty slick.
Oh, yeah, they are.
I mean, you can virtualize your F5 and your Palo anyway.
Oh, yeah, you can.
Really want to,
But fitting a Palo Alto into NSX is a pain in the backside.
And you're paying the licensing for it. That's the thing, right? It's like, you're like, okay, well, if I have to build this out and I have to pay for, you know, two Palo Alto licenses or a dozen PAs, like the more VM series you're running in there, the more you're licensing. You're like, okay, well, maybe at this point, it makes sense to go for VDefend Advanced and do it all native. So this is my hot take. It was like, okay, if I sit back and I stop trying to be angry about that it costs me a lot of money to just run VMs, and I think about, oh, okay, well, I do get all this extra stuff now. Maybe it's time to just use it.
I'm disgusted with myself that I agree with you, but
See, hot take.
And ask yourself, you know, what are we doing here? If that's you, and you suddenly found you've got to pay all these license fees, I was like, what are we doing here? Is this really what we want? Like, let's just get it into cloud, you know?
I think Dave's right in this. If you're going to stay with VMware, use the whole stack. If you just want to run VMs, find some other hypervisor.
Yeah, find some other way to do it.
Yeah, like Citrix is back in the game with Zen Server. It's supported and it costs you 2/5 of bugger all a year. It's like $3,000 a year.
All right. Well, we'll continue to talk about Broadcom anyway because it's fun to talk about.
Yeah, I can switch back to being mean about them now. So
you've had your one nice thing to say about them all year.
Yeah, we'll maintain that line of thought. I think it's certainly interesting. But in the meantime, what's going on at Optus? Oh boy, we don't actually have an official story we're going to talk about on this. We're going to wait till everything precipitates out. But they're in trouble. This is a world of hurt. And you've got some details here for us, Ian.
Yeah, so there's an IT news article that came out a couple of days ago just sort of going over the bits and pieces that they know and that they've told us, which I can tell you now is not a lot. So they made a routine, and we'll use that term in inverted commas, upgrade to their firewall at about 12:30 on the Thursday before the 20th of September. That went awry. When the upgrades and so their CEO has said, when the upgrades and changes were implemented, initial testing and monitoring did not indicate there were any issues with calls connecting. But we know that there was huge issues with emergency services calls connecting and that people died because of it. So that tells me that they're probably not monitoring their 000 calls. And that was before I even got further into the article where they essentially said that. So they said further down the article, further, there were no alarms to alert us that some emergency calls were not making it through to emergency services. So they're not monitoring their emergency calls at all. They're just hoping and praying that they all get through. They were made aware of the problems at about 9 a.m. on last Thursday morning when a customer contacted their call center. And then a second customer made a similar report. Neither of those were escalated or red flagged by their call center.
000, and yeah. You do nothing about
and
it.
And you're just ignoring it, going, it's a random event. It'll be fine.
Wait, so the change happened at like midnight? When you say like 12:30, it wasn't lunchtime, right?
No, it was 12:30 a.m.
And then 9 hours later.
Yeah, almost 9 hours later, they had two calls to the call center. So in 9 hours, multiple calls to emergency services weren't connected. And then 9 hours after that change was implemented, they got two phone calls from customers saying, hey, your emergency services calls aren't working. And they did nothing about them. And then
this must be, there was a piece that came out in the news last night saying it was human error at the overseas call center, and that's probably what they're referring to.
Well, that would be what they're referring to. So Stephen Roo's gone on to say, early reviews suggest that we had not handled the calls as we would expect. That's a fairly obvious statement. The telco remained largely in the dark until 1:30 p.m. the following day when it was escalated directly by another customer. Followed by South Australia Police at 1:50 on Thursday, some 13 hours after the problem started.
What does it take? The police to call?
Yeah.
So what percentage, because obviously some calls are getting through.
Well,
there's no
details that I can find on that yet.
Here's the thing about emergency calls. If you're in an area that doesn't, if you're an Optus customer and you're in an area that doesn't have Optus coverage,
you can still get through.
Telstra will pick it up.
Yep.
Right. So that may have been what's happening.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Right. Okay. So, right. So like if I'm in Optus coverage, it might be fine.
Emergency
the
calls
gateway
are
between the two.
Yeah. Emergency calls are SOS on your mobile service. So even if you don't have signal, you can make a signal on your carrier, you can make it on a different carrier.
That's right.
And
in fact, even if you don't have a SIM in your card, you can make an emergency call.
Yep. Mm. So they said once they were notified by the police, they stopped the upgrade, restoring 000, and began to confirm with stakeholders such as the police and other regulatory and government agencies that they'd impacted 000. So then the Federal Communications Minister, Annika Wells, has come out and had a bit of a kick because that's what politicians do. So she's gone on to say how they've been taken aback about how long it's taken and the gravity that's gone on. Optus are saying that they're still gathering information, but we're sort of, you know, a few days on here and they're still gathering information. They're sort of suspecting that Optus don't actually know themselves what happened.
Yeah.
And why it's happened. But yeah, at this stage, Optus is in a boiling vat at the moment. A boiling vat of oil, I would say.
Look, just cast our minds back to the last time. The last time they had a 000 problem, right, is because of the BGP flooding, right?
Yep.
And we all identified, even us armchair techs, we all identified, look, you shouldn't be putting your 000 calls through the same gateway that all your other calls go through, right? It should be an external network, completely separate, and there should be special rules around doing changes and whatever, whatever.
Yep.
They've not learned.
No.
They've not made any, they've not fixed it.
It doesn't appear so, no. This I think comes as a result of the race to the bottom in costs. So Telstra aren't really in this boat because they're not on a race to the bottom. They don't care whether they're most expensive in the world.
Even when I was working there, they would say, we're not going to compete on price.
No.
They don't compete on price. They compete on product quality.
Yep.
Right.
So on the race to the bottom, if you've got, let's simplify this down to the most simple way of doing it. If you've got two internet-based services there or routes out for calls, and they're both going to cost you $1 million a year, and one of them's getting used 1% of the time and the other one's getting used 50% of the time, you're going to keep the one that's 50% of the time, and the bean counter is going to go get rid of that other one because it costs too much money. Even though that's the one that you put all the 000 calls over.
Yeah, but there's legislation and laws and things that they have to...
Yeah, but bean counters don't care about that. They care about money.
They're compelled to. You know, I would walk into an exchange, a Telstra exchange, and at the end of the suite, there'd be a rack, and it would have on huge red and yellow writing, 000.
Yep.
Do not mess with this, right? And it'll be all locked up, right? And it'd have big battery bank in it, right? And you cannot touch that rack.
And it was the same with when you walked into the cable racks in a Telstra exchange, and normal phone lines were patched with red and white patch cables, right? Twisted pair
on your chrome blocks.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep. So red and white, or the old wire wrap ones where you had to solder them as well. I've worked on them as well.
Done a few of those
that
myself.
That was down at the Toowong Exchange, or Annerley Exchange, sorry. But emergency services. So if you had a line to a police station, an ambulance station, or a fire station, they were all done in purple and white.
Mm.
And those ones were a do not touch.
Do not touch. And you put a sticker on it?
Yep. Well, you never had to, because everybody who worked on the exchanges then knew that if it was purple and white and that was the pair that the access order told you, you didn't touch that for love nor money, because that wasn't worth your backside.
Yeah, right.
You would never get to walk into exchange again if you disconnected them. So,
Must be an administration mistake.
Yeah, that's right. And literally, I had it a few times where I had a service call that I had to go and do, and it specified a pair on the cable side that had a purple and white jumper cable on it. And I'd literally phone up the guys in the access team and go, hey, guys, this pair has a purple and white jumper pair on it. I am not touching it. Give me another pair.
Mm-hmm.
And they would. So, look, this is a huge... I can't say huge enough. This is a huge screw up on Optus's side. I'm sure they're going to keep their telecommunications license, but it's going to cost them a pretty penny, I would say.
Well, they just copped another fine, $100 million.
Yeah, well,
that was on a separate thing, but this is going to cost them a penny too.
Yep.
But I mean, three strikes, you're out. Is that what we're talking about here?
Maybe. Well, they were the ones who lost everybody's license details as well.
Yeah. Well, we didn't even talk about that one, but I mean, this is 2 000 strikes. I'm talking, you know, if they do a third one, Where does it take them?
Well,
like,
surely the light's got to dawn on the marbled heads in Optus and go, hey, maybe we need to implement some special rules around 000 call routing.
Oh, you think?
How about this? Singtel don't give up.
Yeah, well, they probably don't.
Could be that.
But realistically, like, surely.
They must have the same rules in Singapore. I'm so certain they must have. Like, come on.
They'd have to have, like, every country's got their version of 000.
That's right.
In Australia, we've got many.
Yeah, we'll continue to follow the story, of course, and it's going to be, I mean, it's in the public news anyway. The fallout is going to be massive, I think, but we'll see where it takes us. But in the meantime, let's get on with the community news. All right, Ian, take us through it. What have we got here for community news this fortnight?
Righto. So there's only four that I found that are happening within the next sort of few weeks. GDG Sydney has got their meetup on the 1st of October, 5:30 till 8, and it's at the Mandel Group office in Sydney, which is level 21, 580 George Street. You can RSVP on the GDG site for that one. Looks like it's going to be a pretty interesting talk. There's a talk there about elevating your reporting with automated dashboards with AppScript and Looker, and another one with building trustworthy multi-agent customer support insights pipelines with Google Agents SDK, all AI-related stuff. So that one's a good one. Then again in Sydney, the Gen AI Academy workshop. This is happening October 2nd from 5:30 until 9 p.m. And it's at Google Sydney. So it's down at Piermont at Darling Island Road, Piermont. So this event is all about Gen AI, literally everything to do with Gen AI. You get to learn cool stuff. You get to actually implement cool stuff inside of Skills Boost. Yeah, it'll be a good event. So RSVP for that one. Again, it's on the community page that we'll link to. And then we moved down to Melbourne with their really cool banner with the tram on it, which I love. Melbourne's DevFest is on the 4th of October. It is 8 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. It is a full-day event. It's at REA Group at 511 Church Street in Richmond. And what this doesn't cover isn't worth knowing. Literally.
The key themes list goes on for quite a while.
Yeah. This list is huge. So GDG Melbourne always put on a fantastic DevFest event. So if you're not already RSVP'd to that one, get yourself a ticket and get along to that. And then on the 15th of October, which should be before our next podcast, but should be after our next podcast, but I'll mention it anyway, is GDG Melbourne's October Coding Night. It is at Level 2, 452 Flinders Street, which I believe is the Mantle Group office there in Melbourne. And they're doing some Kotlin coding. They've got an RSVP code word, which scares me a little bit. But, you know.
Yeah, okay. Go and give some Kotlin a go. And it's probably worth noting that Adish, previous co-host of GCP Life, he's back. He's back at Mantle Group and he's back helping organise a few of these events as well.
Ooh, he's so, rejoined, has he?
He has, yes. So you can catch up with him there in the Sydney office. Okay, well, with that out of the road, let's get on with the news items. And first news item off this week is finance items, where we usually kick things up. Well, we usually kick things up with people, but we'll move straight on to finance. Google just joined a $3 trillion market cap. Google joined NVIDIA, Microsoft, and Apple in the $3 trillion club after antitrust ruling eased. And we talked about that last episode. There's not going to be any breakup. And then the stocks went soaring. So Alphabet finally crashed tech's most exclusive party on Monday. Google's parent company became only the fourth US firm ever to hit $3 trillion market value when it touched that number in trading today.
Remember when Apple first hit $1 trillion and it was like, that was just huge. Like, oh my, a company is worth $1 trillion. Yeah.
That's insane.
And now we've got four that equals like $12 trillion.
It's not just a single trillion either. It's multi-trillion.
Yeah. More trillions are better, yeah. Right?
No, I've decided once we get to the trillions, then it's worse. It's worse for everybody else that there are $1 trillion companies.
That's right. But so Alphabet reported that cloud revenue has leapt 32% year on year to $13.6 billion in adoption of its in-house TPUs, the Tensor Processing Units, and Gemini AI models. So that puts Google on pace to generate more than $50 billion annually if that growth holds.
Yeah.
Which is, and that's a lot of billions.
It's a lot of billions. And you have to say that Google's AI offering, top to bottom, is a complete offering, right?
Yeah.
You've got the data centers, you've got the chips, you've got the models available, you've got the research going into it, and then you've got Google Cloud just making everything easier for you.
Wasn't it interesting when Google first released Gemini or Bard back then to the public, and we covered it on GCP Life, and we were like, you know, this feels like Google's a bit behind the game and they're just trying to play catch up with OpenAI. And now, look, OpenAI is barely in the news now.
Mm. Mm.
Gemini is everything.
Nano banana, VO3, right? It's all about that. You know, Google got caught with their pants down. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Those early days, they've been chipping away at it for years and years and years, and then suddenly ChatGPT enters the vernacular, and they've had to sort of scramble and play a bit of catch up. But you know, the work that they'd put in prior to that is now starting to show. The quality of the AI product that's being produced now, it's quite mind-blowing.
I suppose it sort of feels like they had a lot of things that were probably about 80% ready to go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, when ChatGPT came out, because it wasn't a priority for them. It was like, we've got time, we can do things in the lab, we're revolutionizing a bunch of stuff, but we hadn't yet productized it, right? But we will one day.
And then
it's like, shit.
Crap, we've got to get on this now.
Send it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Look, I saw an article just the other day, and I don't know whether this one's under NDA or not, but that Google has just released a new update to the guardrails on Gemini. So there's a new update there that's coming out. So I won't go into it because I don't know whether I'm allowed to or not yet. I can't remember whether it was on a private email or on a public one, so we'll leave that one alone until I can find the more information. Maybe next podcast we'll cover it.
Right. Okay. And of course, we're all hanging out for Gemini 3. Any day now. Well, there was that model that was accidentally leaked a few months ago, and they said it was quite stunning. So that could have been Gemini 3, but can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
And so that's what's fueling it, right? That's what's fueling this $3 trillion growth. Ian, without you and I talking, you've read the paragraph that I actually highlighted and I wanted to read as well. So it's the exact same paragraph. No, it's good. It's good. You know, great minds, mate.
Yeah. Feel settled and differ. the other one that I don't know whether you guys know about too is the Gemini on Apple devices. So it's
the Apple equivalent.
No. It's Gemini. It's Gemini. Okay. I think it's actually built into the Google app or maybe it's the Chrome app. That might be part of the Chrome story later. But yeah, there is Gemini on Apple devices now because, you know, Apple's been so crap at releasing Apple intelligence that doesn't exist. That's why they're getting sued.
Right, because they claimed that it existed and they had this fake presentation, right?
Yep.
Is it Gemini Mini or something it's called? Something like that?
I can't remember. But yeah.
I'm going through the AI leader courseware at the moment. I might get the certification, I don't know. And they mentioned AI mini for edge devices.
Yeah.
So you must be able to run that without a TPU, because those Apple phones wouldn't have a TPU, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, you can run their Gemma LLM model on your laptop. Mm. No TPU required.
No TPU required. Or a Commodore 64.
Or a Commodore 64.
There was an article.
Yeah.
I think we discussed
that. If you want to do it at like half a frame a second.
Yeah, $3 trillion club and onwards and upwards. But while they've spent, got some money to spend, they might want to spend it in New South Wales, because the Labor government has approved fast-track approvals for massive data centres in New South Wales. So the New South Wales Treasurer, Daniel Mookie, this is an article from the 15th of September, and so that he would have announced on that day, on Monday, the opening of expressions of interest for the first round of government's new Investment Delivery Authority, which give expenditure approvals of major programs valued at more than $1 billion. So, yeah, if you've got a big project, i.e. a data centre, and wind farms fall into this as well, then, go straight to the New South Wales government and they can fast-track the approval now. This sort of gets rid of a lot of the red tape, gives them a direct line to government and sort of, you know, gets rid of all the local kind of headaches. Where are they going to build these data centers? In Sydney, probably out west somewhere, I'd imagine. Because
they've got a new airport going out there, don't they?
We've got a new big airport going out there. That's an interesting project as well. Because when you think about it, we don't build things like that anymore, right? That kind of infrastructure was kind of built back in the 60s and 70s. But to build a greenfield thing like that, it just doesn't happen, like anywhere in the world. And that was a complete greenfield site, and bang, a new airport was built there. So this is the kind of project that the New South Wales government wants to get. You see them in the US, these big data centers. I mean, we've criticized them before, obviously, the way they do it, because it goes in and it puts the power prices up and it puts the screws up the water table and all the rest of it. But it doesn't matter. It creates jobs, right? We get people here. We've got solar. We've got solar for days. We should be powering these things with solar, right? Solar and batteries should see us through. So these are the kind of projects we want to see come into New South Wales. We certainly got the land, right? We've got the land to put it and the space to spread out and put it.
And it's only $1 million a square meter.
Only $1 million a square meter. Yeah.
That's out west. You can't have that in Sydney. It's 10 in Sydney.
Yeah. Well, in the CBD, that's right. But no, these things won't be going, obviously, in the CBD. Yeah. We want to put them out.
I'm really surprised that you've still got data centers in the CBD, to be honest, because they're such a huge space sink that could be used for residential buildings or other sort of business buildings.
Three letters, man. ASX.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah. You want a data center that's as close to that thing as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's for the latency. Yeah, that's right. But the ones that are in Alexandria, the Equinox ones, SY1 and SY3, Alexandria needed to be gentrified. It was just really a shithole for a long time. It truly was because that area was where like a lot of the heavy industry was, like in the 50s, 60s and 70s, because it was close to the airport, you know, all the cargo and all the industry and stuff was there. And, we've moved on since then. And if a company's going to come and develop a site and bring some value to the area, then that's a good site for it, right? It's close to the sea cables, so they can land the cables, and not too far from the ASX, right? There's plenty of other areas in Sydney where that could be done as well.
Right? Yeah. Oh, well, good on them.
Yeah.
We're going to see more data centers.
See some more data centers, yeah. All right, well, moving on to our favourites, AI overviews. And I think we've been a bit of a I've been using the AI overviews. I find myself using it. I'll do a search and then I'll use it and I'll start reading through it and go, that's not right.
No.
Like that 9 times out of 10, it's like, that's not right. I was doing something the other day. It was music related and I wanted to find some setting in one of these devices over here. Start going through the menus and going, this is not right. This is the wrong thing or whatever. So I actually had to go and get the PDF of the manual that was made in like 1996 and find out like how it worked, you know, and that was correct, obviously. But as a result, Rolling Stone, Billboard owner Penske is suing Google over the AI overviews.
Yeah. So they,
and I'm not surprised.
No, well, they've said here that Google only includes publishers' websites in its search results if it can also use their articles in AI summaries. So what they're alleging here is that without that leverage, Google would have to pay the publishers for the right to republish their work.
They never used to do that before AI overviews. They never used to do that. It was fine then. Yeah. Why is it suddenly now you've got that rule?
Yeah. Well, what they're alleging is that that people aren't visiting their websites anymore because they're seeing the AI overview and.
Absolutely. Yep. Zero-click internet. They're not going to the web, not sending the traffic to the website, so they're not getting the advertising revenue. Like Penske were missing out on the advertising revenue, which I absolutely agree with.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Right? Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. So they're not the only ones that are suing Google over this. So online, so there's an education company online called Chegg, who in February also sued Google, alleging much the same thing.
Yeah.
Google has come out with the quote of all quotes, we will defend against these meritless claims. I love it when companies say that.
Like, it's crap. It is absolutely crap. Like, my wife's business, right, she does educational, like, natural science education to schools and over video conference and all that kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Her website, she pours her heart and spirit into the blog article she writes on her website so that content will get indexed by Google, and then when schools search for it, it sends traffic to her website.
Yep.
Right? And that's the main driver for it, and then she can get bookings from that, right?
Yeah.
And it works. There's no doubt about it. It absolutely works.
Yeah. But
as soon as Google starts to scrape that content and put it into an AI overview, bang, she's lost that traction.
Yeah, that's right.
Lots of traffic.
So, I mean, I don't use the AI overviews at all anymore because I just found them so, like, it's presented as actual fact. And
it looks rubbish.
And quite like, often, it's not.
The aesthetic of it, I mean, it just looks crap.
I don't really care. Like,
I'm ranting here.
You and I both, and Dave, you're probably the same. We've all come from a text-based internet. Right, you remember the old Lynx browser? That brings back memories. So
still use it occasionally.
Yeah, I have actually got it installed here. but look, I don't use it because I find that the results that it gives me are complete nonsense. So to give you an example, I was looking up the other day. I'm trying to learn how to draw things in CAD. All right, I'm not a drafty. I am not someone who can use CAD very well. So I'm trying to teach myself because I've got a 3D printer now. I want to design stuff. So I've installed FreeCAD because I'm a sadist and I want to do everything the hardest way possible. And I'm Googling, I jumped into Google and I was trying to find out how to do a specific thing. And the AI overview was like, oh, you need to go here and here and here. And I got to the first option and it's like, yep, now you need to click this option. That option didn't exist. And I'm like, okay, now where do I go?
And and this has been my problem with it.
Yeah, yeah. It's presenting complete nonsense as fact.
Yeah, it hallucinates. So I don't know where it gets this from. Older versions, you know, instructions for older versions of the software or something, or different revs of it or something.
Yeah, maybe.
It just doesn't... You do a quick search for something, and when you're doing a search, you're not thinking, oh, I'm prompting an AI. You're not thinking like a prompt engineer, right? Like you just want to do a quick search for something, and hopefully it's not an ad that you get, but you get something good, you know. And what do you get? You get a shitty response from an AI that just doesn't have all the context, and you try to take that on its face value, and it's just wrong.
Yeah. Look, and I think Google's got a long way to go before the AI overview is going to be at all relevant to, like, there's going to be a lot of people that use it. And I think it's going to add to a lot of disillusion of what is actually fact. But you know, that's my take on it, because I'm much like the old 80s, 90s type person who will look at three different sources to get what the actual truth is.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Penske don't like it either. No. It is alleged that about 20% of Google searches that link to its site now show AI overviews. A share it expects to rise, and added that its affiliate revenue has fallen by more than a third from its peak by the end of 2024 as search traffic declined. Yep. So it's having an effect.
Yep.
And they don't like it, and they're going after Google, and they should. So others should as well. I just think it's garbage at the moment, and the whole idea of one-click internet is just going to destroy the internet.
Yep.
As far as I can, that's my take on it.
Well, all it's going to do is make the companies that produce the AI overviews the ones of the arbiters of truth.
Exactly, and that's not what we want. No. We want an open internet, right? But anyway, moving on, speaking of takeovers, Intel and NVIDIA sitting in a tree.
NVLink ING.
NVLink ING. Now, who put this in here?
I dropped this in. Yeah. So,
I love that title.
Yeah. This is one from the Register. So we love throwing a Register article in. But yeah, so NVIDIA is set to become one of the largest shareholders of Intel alongside the US government. after the GPU giant announced on Thursday it would invest $5 billion into the struggling chip maker. This is going to be very interesting.
A lot of knock-on effects.
This is going to be interesting. The article actually talks about this, is the ability then for NVIDIA to embed GPUs into the CPU and become part of the integrated graphics market.
Oh, what does that sound like?
Yeah.
Doesn't it sound like AMD buying ATI?
Uh-huh.
This is
reverse of it, right?
Max of that, yeah.
You know, back at the time when they bought ATI, they were looking at buying NVIDIA.
Mm. Yeah, wow. The tables have turned.
Yeah.
But then again, remember when we used to get NVIDIA chips embedded in the Intel chipset?
You had a different chipset. And that was to be able to do not Crossfire, that's the AMD one, SLI.
SLI, yeah, that's
SLI.
It.
You needed to have the NVIDIA Northbridge to be able to do it. Yeah, different motherboards.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there would actually be, and I've got a motherboard still, has a GT6500 GPU in the motherboard.
Oh. There you go.
There were motherboards produced with NVIDIA
on board.
Look at
on
you board buying the all the fancy gear. I never had one of them.
I had one. It was actually my home theater PC, and it worked very well because I wanted it in a slimline box, and it was an embedded NVIDIA chip in the motherboard.
Best I got was an S3
not
Verge.
Just a Northbridge.
Best I got was an S3 Verge built into the mainboard, but you know, that's showing my age a bit.
Yeah. Oh, S3. So, interesting. Now, the other little wrinkle is going to be with the Intel graphics unit, their desktop.
So they're competing with their, like, Battlemage and their Arc range of GPUs, which finally have just started to actually make some progress. They seem to be quite well-regarded, this current generation that's just sort of come out.
I thought Intel canned all of that as just a folly.
They did like years ago, and then they started to come back in. They were like, oh, we're going to start coming back into having actually discrete GPUs alongside our iGPUs.
Nice.
Because of how expensive NVIDIA and AMD graphics cards have got, the Intel ones have actually been pretty good. So this will change things up a bit.
Yeah.
Might see that get downplayed. Maybe we only get like one more generation out of Arc.
Yeah, we'll see what happens because they seem to have found a niche in their market with that, right? Like, you're right. The AMD and NVIDIA were very expensive, but for their purpose, the Intel GPUs seem to have found a spot in the market.
Yeah, you don't need to be the absolute top tier. You don't need a 5090 competitor.
So who knows? Maybe NVIDIA will spin that off into a new line, or just keep it as like your Toyota Lexus kind of arrangement.
maybe we'll end up with like iGPU, like the base ones, like the Intel simple iGPUs in a lower product tiers, and then maybe they integrate an NVIDIA one as well, probably in the mobile space.
Well, it's saying here that they'll be able to offer the NVL72 style systems on Intel Xeons, which that would be pretty cool because then you could have some sort of LLM type processing inside of an Intel Xeon. It'll give it a bit more capability.
Yeah. So because of the way you had PCI Link, like they're only a certain amount of paths, if you had Intel CPUs, you could only have 8 GPUs. If you wanted to have higher density systems to fit a lot more GPUs in it, you were pretty much having to go to ARM to do it.
Yeah.
Because Qualcomm had these chipsets.
Yeah, so the NVLink that they – because the PCI is slow by comparison. This NVLink does, it says it here in the article, yes, 900 gigabytes per second in each direction. So it's 1.8 terabytes per second of bandwidth, which it says here is 14 times the bandwidth of a PCI 5 X16 slot.
Mm.
So it's lightning quick by comparison. So building in an NVIDIA GPU into a Xeon and having NVLink inside the Xeon would give it the capability of doing not only the server processing stuff, but also GPU-based processing and potentially LLM models as well.
Yeah, or thinking really long-term, could we see motherboards come out with NVLink instead of PCIe?
Well, that's possible too.
Right.
Yeah, see what the PCI SIG thinks about that because, they'll be coming soon with PCI 7. And
Well, I mean, they've got a long way to catch up.
PCI 7 now integrated with NVLink.
Yeah.
So might end up in a Thunderbolt USB situation where it's like it's the same port but it does everything.
Yeah. So I see this as possibly a really good thing insofar as if they did integrate an NVIDIA chip into a Xeon and put NVLink into it, you would get a lower cost version of NVIDIA's really high end, like
Grace Hopper.
Yeah. The really high end graphics GPUs that they're using for LLMs and like all the AI stuff.
Yeah, the H200s.
That's the ones. So you could get a really low-cost version of that. Well, low-cost is relative because, H200s are hundreds of thousands of dollars and a Xeon is not.
Hey, but imagine that. I mean, NVIDIA have a thing built into their graphics cards, which was like an option, got the PhysX chip, and it does real world physics modeling, right? And it's just a normal like ragdoll physics and all this kind of. It does all that calculation. Why not have like this coprocessor idea built in somewhere like a TPU?
Yeah,
like that's what's coming. We're going to have TPUs in our desktop and laptop machines.
Yep,
got them in our phones already. That's only because Google has got the speed to market with it, but this is where this is going.
Yeah, I like it. I think this might be a good thing.
Mm.
Well, I mean, Intel needs all the help they can get at the moment, right? Mm. We don't want to see them drop out of the market. We need to have that competition there. So, yeah.
Yep.
Fingers crossed. And, companies sometimes need to cross-invest as well. I mean, like, Microsoft saved Apple back in the day, right?
Yeah.
And now they're both $3 trillion companies, so.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's interesting because I like when you have a look at certainly in Google, if you have a look at like the AMD EPYC chips that they use versus the Xeon Gold that they use, the AMDs actually come out on top in benchmarks. But and not by a small margin either. They are phenomenal chips.
Yeah, my desktop is an AMD. I'll always go AMD these days.
Yep. I do like the AMDs, but you know, I couldn't find a laptop that was decent spec'd with an AMD processor in it.
There's still a very poor showing in the laptop space, considering how good the chips are, but that's on the vendors. That's
also on the Intel, like manufacturers going, oh, well, you know, everybody wants an Intel because Intel are the recognized leader. And realistically, they're probably not anymore.
Yeah.
But hey.
And one thing we didn't touch on, what about the fabs? Is this going to give NVIDIA access to Intel's fabs?
I don't think they want them.
Okay. don't know that it's really going to make a huge difference.
They're not leading edge.
No. No, well, see, that's one of the things that they've got to pick up too, because of this whole manufacturing everything in the United States thing. They're going to have to pick up their fabrication business quite a lot.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, they were not allowed to divest of their fabs as part of that US investment.
Yeah.
All right, another one we're going to watch, but let's get on. We've gone on a bit this week, but let's get on with some security news.
You have to speed run the rest of the podcast.
Speed run the rest of it, yeah. Void proxy. Fishkit targets Google and Microsoft users. Targeting Microsoft and Google accounts, the phishing as a service, FASH, well, that's hard to pronounce, platform named Void Proxy can circumvent MFA methods such as short messaging service codes and one-time passwords, Okta said.
Yeah. So I put this one in here because this was a bit scary. So Void Proxy uses an adversary in the middle phishing with emails sent from legitimate providers but using compromised accounts. So the phishing kites are on low-cost TLDs, such as ICU, SBS, XYZ, etc. And they use Cloudflare reverse proxy to actually hide their IP address. I love how articles flesh out the entire name of things. So instead of calling an IP address that everybody knows, they call it an internet protocol address. And I had to read that three times to go, oh, they mean an IP address, right. They do it further down the article as well. So they use Cloudflare's capture to ensure that only humans click through, so that they can reduce their exposure to being caught. And once a user's been tricked into supplying their credentials, users that have been federated and set up to use SSO are redirected to second stage landing pages, whereas Void Proxy sends non-federated directly to Microsoft and Google services. So there's a few layers to this. The bit that I find a little bit amusing and a little bit scary as well is that they actually have a whole admin panel that shows details about how their phishing campaign efforts are playing out. Like full on. This is your marketing campaign, and this is your return on investment.
Yeah, here's your open rate, your click rate,
exactly.
Conversions.
Here's how often you've been caught as a dirty phishing attacker and binned. The other area that they expanded on a full abbreviation was DNS. And again, I had to read it a couple of times to try and figure out what they were saying. It's like they steal.
They're trying to hit their word limit.
The Void Proxy attack steals the session cookies through their adversary in the middle, which they call an AITM, which is also a weird acronym. Running a reverse proxy via ephemeral infrastructure with dynamic domain name system or domain name services. And then after user's authenticated. So. Look, it's a scary one because if it's catching people and compromising their accounts, then that's bad. But I don't really know how you protect against this one.
So this phishing, as I said, I could just go and spin this up like my own thing and then set up my own phishing site and st- start, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Start collecting passwords. 100%
you can. It's the same as the next one we're going to cover. It's also an attack as a service. So, yeah. They've
come a long way. I suppose they've got a GitHub repo. You can go download the code, install it.
More than likely. Or it's one of those ones that you've got to pay and it's all hidden on Tor and the likes.
Yeah. Void proxy.
Yep. Yeah, nasty bit of kit.
Nasty bit of stuff, yeah. Plenty of stuff online about it. Go check it out. And the next one, Shiny Spider. Ransomware as a service. This one's going after your VMwares. Unlike traditional ransomware that targets Windows endpoints or network file shares, Shiny Spider is engineered specifically to infect and encrypt VMware ESXi hypervisors and their attached data stores. Oh, this one is scary.
Yeah. I mean, and this particular type of attack is the one that we covered about a month or so back, where like Google released a fantastic deep dive on how these attacks work and how you can mitigate against them.
Yep.
All right. So it's definitely, we'll have to throw that one back in again, because it's something that every like VMware engineer and security person should be across.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
This one's nasty because it disables your snapshots. So once it's deployed, the ransomware enumerates all VMs, disables snapshot functionality, and begins simultaneous AES 256 encryption of each VMDK file. So it's simultaneous encryption. So surely you'd be looking for increased CPU usage across your entire fleet. But by that stage, once it's done, it's encrypted. It's blow the machine away and start again, and change the password that it used.
And it all starts with a compromised SSO or SSH key.
Yep.
Simple as that.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty simple to deploy. And it's a compromise via vishing. I'd never heard of that term before. But it's
voice phishing. Yeah, vishing. Yeah, I think maybe it was the week you were away. We have mentioned this on the show, vishing before. Yeah, the same idea. Nasty one. Basically, it's a good argument to have offsite backups or disconnected backups.
Disconnected backups, 100%.
Yeah.
And do not have your backups integrated with Active Directory. Have that on its own separate system, right?
Yep.
Also, don't have your VMware environment actually domain joined. Never do that.
No. Bad your practice. ESXi host shouldn't be domain joined. They should accept SSO, but but not domain join your hosts.
Yeah, because that's just inviting them to come in, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Well, with those two nasty ones out of the way, let's get on with the AI Wars.
AI Wars.
AI Wars.
It's more elaborate every week.
Need a lozenge after that. look, and first one this fortnight, and we knew it was coming. Google adds Gemini to Chrome browser after voiding antitrust breakup. And we knew it was coming, and they waited for the results of the court case. There's no doubt about it, and now they've announced it. Google will integrate Gemini into its Chrome browser for users in the US just weeks after federal judge spared the company from a forced breakup in an antitrust case.
Yeah, so it's only going to be available at this point for Mac and Windows users in the US with their language set to English, because reasons. And starting soon, Apple's iOS Chrome app will also have Gemini built into it. That's where I saw it. You'll be able to actually have AI on an Apple device because reasons.
I mean, we haven't gone into that on the show, but they're in a shambles. There's many videos on YouTube you can find out about that, but Apple's AI is in a shambles. I wonder how it's going to look, because at the moment, if you open Firefox now, you get the little chat box. You can open the it's a chat box on the side that you can open. You can go Anthropic, Claude, ChatGPT, Copilot, Gemini, or Lee Chat Minstrel. I'm just looking at it now. But I wonder how it's going to look. Do we have any indications on that? Like how it's going to function?
100% AI overview.
God, don't!
It'll be the bait and switch, you watch. It'll be like there's going to be a box over the side and then all of a sudden it's just going to take over the browser and you're it. You've got AI overview for life.
And what?
Yeah.
I just hope they don't screw it up because it could be really awesome or it could just be a privacy nightmare. Like, yeah. As if Chrome isn't already a privacy nightmare as it is.
It's interesting because they're doing this, well, obviously because they were waiting until after the judgment came down on whether they'd have to sell off Chrome or not. But also they're doing this in order to compete with others. So the Perplexity company has already provided a browser that has an agentic AI in it, which is called Comet. But that company also made in August a $34.5 billion all cash offer for Chrome off Google.
Yeah, I think they were just throwing that out there, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, whether they were or not, it sort of gives you an idea of how big that company already is.
But it's like, what can it do? Like, what's it going to do? Is it going to integrate the browsing experience somehow? Is it going to manage your tabs? Like, I know I've got like a million bookmarks. I could really do with some sort of AI assistant there. Like, and because these are just bookmarks I've dragged around with me for years and years and years. Not that I use bookmarks anymore, but there's so many in there that I need help with that. How's it going to work? That's my question.
I think very similar to the way that Perplexities works in their Comet browser is it'll be able to summarize stuff for you. Like you can load up a web page and tell the AI to summarize that web page for you.
Well, that'd be handy.
Same with videos.
Oh, okay. So the same way we see it working in Workspace, in Google Workspace.
Yeah.
Okay. That would be interesting. All right.
And also noted at the bottom of this article, and I find this hilarious, but I'm going to say it, Apple has approached Google to use Gemini AI to revamp the Siri voice assistant. Because Gemini is already in Samsung products, so it's the AI in Samsung phones. Obviously, it's on Google phones, and soon to be the driver of Siri.
If that happens, I would go as far to say that Google have won the AI wars.
Yep.
If they're on all the platforms like that.
Yep. There you go.
Banky's called it. AI war is over.
AI wars are over.
The war has been won.
All right. And then to finish up for the AI wars this week, and I'd never thought about this problem before, but Google Cloud unveils open protocol for agentic payments. Now, this is very interesting, right? So Google Cloud has launched the Agentic Payments Protocol, AP2, in an effort to establish a global standard for secure payments initiated by autonomous artificial agents. Now, when you think about it, this is where we're going, right? You need a way to verify and then, authenticate who's representing who if you've got these little agents running around doing stuff for you. And this is what this protocol does. And it's not just like Google like going, hand-waving, saying, oh, this is how we're going to do it. Here's how we're going to do it. No, there's been a few people. There's been 60 technology collaborators involved, including MasterCard, PayPal, American Express, and a major Southeast Asian e-commerce platform such as Lanzar and Shopee. So they're all on board with this. And we're going to have a world where our agentic AI agents are doing our shopping for us. Kind of sounds cool, but also kind of sounds terrifying.
I suppose it's like having an assistant or giving someone like a grant of authority of being like, all right, here is your budget. You can spend this amount of money. This is the outcome I want. This is what you can spend.
Yes, that's right. And the protocol's about having those rules that say, I'm allowed to do this, I'm allowed to do that, and everyone, you know, everyone agrees. Interesting idea. I suppose this is specifically for financial transactions, but we're going to need protocols for all sorts of transactions for agents, right?
Yeah, quite possibly.
Can I have an agent? I would like to acquire a property of these dimensions. Here is your $800,000 budget and go and sign the contracts.
I want 50 hectares. Here's $800,000. Find me. It needs to be within 100 kilometers of where I currently am.
I was thinking, well, how would I use this? You know, I like to buy music equipment. I don't think that's been missed on you guys. A lot of it's secondhand, right? Because you're after a piece of equipment that's got a certain sound or a certain vibe, right? And there's a few marketplaces you can go to look for this stuff. There's a Facebook marketplace, there's Gumtree, there's Reverb, and there's eBay. Now, I enjoy like looking at them and looking at their gear, but wouldn't it be cool to have an agent that could look at all of those marketplaces and I say, I want this piece of equipment and I'm prepared to pay this amount for it. Off you go, work at it for me. And then before you know it, you get an email say, this is being delivered. You go, all right, I've got it.
Yeah, nice.
That would be an excellent use of this, right? Just take that.
I still don't know that I'm comfortable enough with AI to leave it with the ability to spend my money.
That's where we're going, though.
Call me a Scrooge McDuck, but I don't know that I'm quite that comfortable yet.
Well, it's like making a bid on something on eBay, right? So everyone wants to snipe, right? When they bid on eBay, but that's not how it works, yeah. Right? You go to the thing on eBay and you say, right, I want to spend this. That's my budget. I want to spend this on that item. You put the bid in and you might win it, or there could be another bidder that's higher. But if you're the winning bidder, that you've got it until someone else comes along and bids higher, and then you miss out.
Yeah. Right? And I don't think sniping tools should be allowed on eBay, to be honest. That's
Same idea. You put it into the agent and say, right, I want to get this at this price. I don't care where it comes from. You go away and do the work. Mm. It might take 6 weeks. It might take 8 weeks, but eventually I'll get it at that price. Yep.
Nice.
Yeah, cool idea. It will be coming. We'll be getting this for sure. There'll be tools that'll do this for us. Cool. All right. Well, that wraps up the show for this fortnight. It's been a fantastic show. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Still trying out YouTube Music. It's okay. Go to Apple Podcasts, write a review. That'll really help the show out. And go to YouTube. While you're there, start the discussion and smash that like button. You can contact the show, contact@gcbbytes.com.au. Find us on the web, www.gcbbytes.com.au. And don't forget, today's sponsor are Hivetech Solutions. Apparently, they've got a big new printer and they can print all sorts of stuff for you now. Technofish Consulting and Mantle Group. That's the mob that I work for. And you can go there and get involved with all the GDG events. That's about it from us. Anything else from you guys?
No,
only new Google Nest devices coming next week. So, you know, we'll be able to talk on next podcast. Right.
We want to talk all about that and find out what they're doing with the Google Nest. Excellent. All right. Well, that's it. We'll catch you later. Bye.
Bye.
I want to see them. A Salvador Dali-esque moustache.
It's going.
Proper is.
Oh, it's going to be out here before I start.
Oh, God. God.
Curling it.
You're going to have to go, you know, re-enlist and work your way back to Warren Officer. That's a Warren Officer ass mustache.
Get off the fucking grass.
Get one of them nice sticks.
Yeah, pay stick.